So thanks a lot to all of you for coming. Thanks for Lucien for inviting me, and Ravi and Rob. It's a very big pleasure to be here again. It lasted a while since I came the last time, and coming to Perimeter is always an exciting experience. So I'm going to talk about higher order quantum computations and causal structures. And this is some collection of results that are quite recent and derived personally and in collaboration with Alessandro Bisio, who is a postdoc in our group in Pavia, even though the whole construction relies on a lot of work that we did in collaboration, in particular with Mauro D'Ariano and Giulio Chiribella, that was formerly in Pavia and formerly here. And the whole point of this is to study the most general class of admissible quantum transformations. So in order to start, I would like to review some very common notion about the usual quantum transformations we are used to talk about, which are quantum channels, that are the mathematical description of devices that take some input state, quantum input state, and transform it into some quantum output state. And more generally, instead of a quantum channel, we can think of a quantum instrument, a collection of quantum operations that describes also a flow of information out of the quantum system to the classical domain, and the outcomes of the measurement are the labels of conditional transformations that occur on the system. So in the mathematical formalism, all these things rely on the description of states of a system through density matrices. And then the most general transformation you can have on states, which conserves the physical properties of states, the normalization and positivity of probabilities, are completely positive maps. In the diagrams that I use, this is the application of a completely positive map that I call M to a state of a system A prepared in a state row. And the complete positivity is equivalent to the Krauss form and is essentially the requirement that if you act locally with a map on a part of an entangled state, of a bipartite state, you preserve all the properties of the state, even though the map is applied only locally. And a special case of transformation is that of a map that takes a system and maps it into a trivial system of dimension one. This is a POVM, so an effect, actually. A single map is an effect, and a collection of such maps that sums up to deterministic transformation is a POVM. So the action of this map on the state is given by the Born rule. So this is the diagram, and this is the extraction of a probability out of the quantum state. So all these maps can be derived constructively by considering that generally quantum system evolve unitarily, and if you discard the environments of a unitary that makes the system interact with an environment, then what you get in general is a completely positive maps. However, the most interesting part of the story is that you can derive completely positive maps out of axioms, admissibility conditions that are linearity, complete positivity, namely preservation of positivity and of states even when the map is applied locally, and defining the deterministic transformations as those that preserve the trace. So non-deterministic transformations are all those that don't increase the trace. This is the signature of a quantum operation. So out of all these axioms, you can derive with a nice theorem this realization, physical realization of any completely positive map. So any completely positive map can be thought of as a unitary interaction with an environment which is prepared in a pure state and then after the interaction is discarded. So up to now, this is just a review of well-known results. And also in this slide, I will just review the realization of an instrument, which is obtained quite in the same way, apart from the fact that in this case, instead of just discarding the environment, you do a measurement on the environment, and conditionally on the outcome, you get the conditional transformation on the system. So this is the most general description, for example, of a quantum measurement. So all this construction implicitly relies on a property of quantum theory, which is causality, that can be thought of in this way. So suppose that you have a preparation, which is not a simple preparation of a deterministic state, but a preparation of a pool of states in a range. Okay, all the states are labeled by some index I. So you have a source that from time to time prepares one state, from time to time prepares another state, and tells you every time which one has been prepared. So I is the index, the label that tells you which state has been prepared in a given instance. So if you perform a measurement on this preparation, you get a joint probability distribution for the label of the state and the outcome of the measurement. And the causality requirement is the following. So if you marginalize this joint probability distribution, what you expect to get is, if you forget the outcome of the measurement, you expect that the source will prepare the state rho I with a fixed probability, which is a property of the source. And there's nothing in the measurement device that influences this probability distribution. However, if you take the most general situation, there's no reason why, once you marginalize on the outcome J, the joint probabilities, the probability distribution that remains for the state rho I does not depend on the choice of the measurement Q. Okay, but there's no reason why this should not occur. And causality is precisely the requirement that this does not occur. So this probability only depends on the state rho I, but once you sum over the outcomes, you forget about which measurement you performed. Okay, so this probability is not sensitive to what measurement you performed on the system. And this gives you, in the quantum case, the probability of preparation proportionate, actually equal to the trace of the density matrix that describes the state rho I. So this requirement can be extended to general operational probabilistic theories, and is exactly the requirement that if you sum over the outcomes of a measurement, then the probability distribution of the state does not depend on the choice of measurement that you do. So it's easy to prove that the statement is equivalent to the uniqueness of a deterministic effect. In the quantum case, the unique deterministic effect is the one that you get when you trace the state with the identity. In the general probabilistic theory, it's a unique functional that gives you probability out of states. So once you have this structure, you can interpret the input-output flow of transformations as the passing of time, okay? In the sense that you don't need time to define causality. Causality is a property of the processing of data in a quantum circuit or in a general circuit in a causal probabilistic theory. And once you impose causality, it's safe to think of the input-output flow as the flow of time. So you cannot condition events in the past. You cannot do strange things like communication backwards in time. For example, if you think of a closed circuit like that, which usually describes the joint probability for all the events that occur within the circuit, then you can always split it in two parts, like a preparation and a measurement, like this. And since the causality constraint tells you that the probability of these outcomes cannot depend on the choice of this red part of the circuit, which is the measurement, then, for example, the probability of this outcome I7 cannot depend on the choice of what you do here. So you see, even though this transformation occurs in a step which is previous with respect to the box F, still you cannot have influences from here to there. And that's because you don't have interactions between the outputs of C and the inputs of F, okay? So causality implies no signaling without interaction. And if you phrase this in a general circuit, in a complex circuit like that, well, it turns out that the causality constraints is equivalent to sort of relaxed and generalized Minkowskian structure on the circuit. So you have cones, causal cones, future causal cones for any event in the circuit, and also you have a causal present. So everything which is in the causal present could be shifted after the event or before the event without affecting the total behavior of the circuit. So the causality requirement. In principle, yes. You can identify them once in a theory you have causality. If you don't, then you run into strange situation, paradoxical situation. For example, one thing that you cannot safely do if you don't have causality is to read information from the outcomes in the past and use them to condition your choices of operations that you do in the future. Because then you would run into supernormalized probabilities or negative probabilities and things like that. Anyway, this is widely discussed in the book that we recently published with Mauro and Giulio in last February. And the basic idea that I want to stress is just that the causality constraint on the circuits in the end of the day is a translation of the usual Minkowskian causality structure, the usual causality of special relativity. Okay, so the description of transformation in terms of channels, completely positive maps, relies on the causality of quantum theory. Another important feature of channels is that they can be described through the Choi representation. This is a mathematical theorem, and the Choi representation of a channel is just what you get if you apply locally the channel on, for example, on this system, system A, to prepared, so in a bipartite state, generalized state, supernormalized state, which is represented by the this operator omega, and the vector psi is just this, is proportional to this maximally entangled state. So if you prepare the system of two copies of the input system into this state, and then you apply the map to one of the parties, then you get the Choi operator corresponding to the map. And why is the Choi isomorphism useful? Because it gives you a very immediate, very simple characterization of complete positivity in terms of positivity of this operator. Okay. So a map is completely positive if and only if its Choi operator is positive, definite. And then we can treat maps as positive operators. So we can treat them as if they were states. And you will see that this allows us to define maps on maps as completely positive maps on the Choi operators. So one important thing that comes with causality is the normalization of deterministic events. For example, deterministic states are characterized by trace equal to one, and deterministic transformations, which are quantum channels, are those that whose Choi operator has a partial trace on the output system, which is equal to the identity on the input system. So you take the Choi operator, you take the partial trace on the output system, and what you get is identity on the input system. And in the special case of effects, this condition turns out to be just this one. So the unique deterministic effect is death, which is proportional to the identity. So now what happens if we go to higher order transformations? If you consider transformations of completely positive maps, of Choi operators that describe channels or quantum operations. So we have a situation which can be physically be thought of in this way. A black box, this black box accepts the channel as an input, provides possibly some information, and provides a channel, a conditional channel, as an output. Okay. So what is the most general map of this kind that you can think of? Okay. First of all, a consideration about causality. When you go to this kind of maps, differently from the case of states, where the application of a map transforms a state in the past to a state in the future, here the transformation of a channel doesn't bring it from the past to the future. And a simple example can illustrate this concept, which is the following. So consider a fixed channel, is the green one. And now consider the map that you obtain by postponing the channel to your input, which is the blue one. So what you get is a new channel, the red one, but by no means you could say that this comes in the future of the blue box, okay? So there's no causal ordering between the input and the output when the map occurs on the channel. So somehow the causality property gets messed up when you go to the higher order. And we will see a trace of this when we'll see the effects on channels. How do we characterize these kind of transformations on channels? So we take the same procedure that I illustrated in the axiomatic presentation of channels. That is, we impose some reasonable constraints. First of all, linearity, which is the preservation of convex combinations. Complete positivity. So when you act with your black box on a part of a bipartite channel, then what you get is still a valid channel or a valid quantum operation. And you define deterministic maps as those with which preserve the normalization constraint of channels. Probabilistic is any map that can be complemented by another map to a deterministic one. So these are the admissibility constraints for a transformation occurring on channels. And you can impose the normalization constraint in this case in this way. And you see that the normalization constraints differ from the ones that you have when you impose normalization on maps that act on a causal theory. So the input is normalized in this way, which is different from the normalization of states, which is simply trace equal to one. So the partial trace is equal to the identity. This implies that the deterministic maps must be normalized in this way, which is the following. So take the operator S that corresponds to the map given by the black box. Okay? If you partially trace on the last system that you have here, D, the output of system of the output channel, you get identity on system B, which is this one, the output system of the input channel, tensor, another positive operator, which acts on the space of the other two systems. And then when you trace on the on this other system, A, you remain with an identity on the last one. So you have a cascade of conditions which are much more complex than the simple condition that you had here for channels. So when you impose these conditions on maps with trivial output D and trivial input C, you get those maps that represent effects on channels. These maps take a channel and transform it into a probability. And you see that the normalization constraint for this kind of maps is this one, where rho A is any state that you can prepare here on the system A. So you see that the deterministic effect is not unique in that case. You have actually a continuum of possible different deterministic effects. So this is a signature that causality is lost when you think of transformations on channels. And that's the mathematical translation of the fact that I told you before. You cannot think of the output channel as following the input in time. Okay. However, as a general theorem, we can again derive a realization scheme starting just from the general admissibility constraints. So, as in the case of channels, if you start from an axiomatic presentation of completely positive map, you end up with a physical scheme for their implementation. In this case, you impose these admissibility conditions on the higher order transformation, and you end up with a physical scheme, which is of this kind. So you prepare a circuit made of two isometries and possibly a measurement with a slot in the middle. And the application of the map to the channel is just the insertion of the input channel into this circuit. Okay, so this is the most general map satisfying admissibility condition. You can realize it in a lab with this scheme. So you can push the generalization a little bit further. And for example, you start saying that a quantum channel or a quantum operation is a one comb because it has a one tooth. And you define recursively n combs as map that take as an input n minus one combs with a toothless, and map them into channels. So something like that. So the blue one is your input, and the gray one is the map, and the output will be a channel. So this recursive definition gives you even more general normalization constraints with respect to those that I introduced for supermaps acting on channels. And these constraints are given by this cascade of partial traces. So essentially, you can read this condition in this way. So you start tracing on the last system, you get identity on the first to the last, tensor, a positive operator. Then once again, you trace on the second to the last, you get identity on the third to the last, tensor, a positive operator. and then you go on tracing on the last system and you get identity on the remaining one, tensor positive operator, until you get to the first tooth, which is just a channel. You trace here and you get identity on the zero system. Okay, so causality propagates on higher order maps because the normalization constraints for states is the one given by causality, and it enforces the normalization constraint on channels. And then when you define maps on channels, this normalization constrains the normalization of deterministic maps on channels, and so on and so forth. So despite causality is lost when you go to higher order maps, you keep track of it in the normalization constraint of all these maps. And indeed, these normalization constraints correspond to a causal structure, as you will see immediately now, where I show you the realization theorem for comms. Also in this case, you can define comms in terms of admissibility conditions. So every time you go up by one order, you impose complete positivity, linearity, and the deterministic comms are those that preserve the normalization constraint for the comms in the transform deterministic comms of with one teeth less to deterministic channels. And what you get is that comms or collection of comms that sum to a deterministic one correspond to a circuit like that with many open slots, but that follow each other because you always have some quantum memory in principle that keeps track of what occurred in the previous step. Okay, so the input and the output of a comb are not ordered in time, although the comb has an inner causal structure, an ordering of teeth, which is given by the flow of information through the ancillary system that you have in the realization scheme. Okay. So essentially, what I showed you is that any circuit, this is the action of a comb on a smaller comb. So the connection is, of course, given by this connection of the two circuits. So essentially, what this realization theorem shows is that comms are in one-to-one correspondence with quantum circuits with open slots. So everything that you can achieve implementing a quantum circuit and leaving some parts open to a modular connection are described by quantum comms. So the question is, now I will go to generalization of this concept, but the question is, why do we need this? You really need something more than what you can describe by circuits, and I hope I will try to convince you that this is the case. So first of all, you can define higher order transformations. As you can easily imagine, you can define maps from comms to general comms, for example, instead of maps from comms to channels. And then you can go on and define maps from these new kind of maps to channels, or maps from these new kind of maps to maps of the same kind, and so on and so forth. So the hierarchy of higher order transformation can proceed, in principle, infinitely far. So why studying the generalizations? Because already in the easiest cases, there have been studies that show that they can provide advantages, for example, computational advantages. You can discriminate pools of unitary transformation with a single use instead of two uses that are the ones that you would be required in a quantum circuit. And in general, this is a new subject, largely unexplored, so it's open to many interesting results, hopefully. But these are good reasons to study generalization of these maps. But before going on, I need to introduce some language that allows me to talk about these higher order maps. And then let me construct, first of all, a hierarchy of types of maps. So before understanding what are the maps, I need to say what type of maps I can think of. And so the type construction proceeds in this way. So I have elementary types that are the types of quantum systems, okay? Labels given by capital Roman letters. And then I have this special quantum system, which is the trivial one, the system with a one-dimensional Hilbert space. Then I have a simple rule to construct new types. Every time I have a type X and a type Y, I can add an arrow in the middle and construct a new type, which is a type of transformations from objects of type X to objects of type Y. So for example, when I compose two elementary systems in this way, I get the type of quantum operations or channels from system A to system B. And then if X is this and Y is this, I get transformations from channels to channels, and so on and so forth. So every time I have two valid types, I can construct a new type with this simple rule. Okay. And then I use this shorthand for linear functionals. So this particular type of maps that take the general type X to the trivial system. So these maps take an object of type X and produce probabilities. And I will denote them by this overline, even though they are simply maps of this type with the output given by the trivial system. For example, effects are the overline of A. Effects on system A are those type of maps which are overline A. So a general type would look like something like that. Okay, this is just one random expression that I took just to give you an idea of what a type would look like. A basic rule is that whenever you have the type that takes the trivial system into X, this is simply the type X. And a good thing about the hierarchy of types is that they are ordered, naturally ordered, in this way. I will say that X arrow Y follows both X and Y. Okay, so in this way, I have a well-founded binary relation that allows me to do proofs by induction. This is fundamental because whenever I want to prove a property that propagates on the whole hierarchy of transformations, I will use it. I will use typically proofs by induction using this well-founded ordering.
So, can you draw a diagram for the general, the example of a general type you have at the top?
This one.
Yeah. Just on the blackboard, do you have is there a diagram corresponding to that? Just so I can understand.
So this is a map from a channel into a comb. So this will map something like that to a comb of this type. So this is A2C. And here you have okay. The D bar would be D times identity. So here I would have an trivial system. Sorry, identity I, and this would be a trivial system. I don't draw it. So the map is of this kind, and the diagram for this map wouldn't be causally ordered. Okay. This kind of transformations will be the subject of the next part of the talk. We will see more on this. But essentially, you can think of this as something like that. So here, you plug this input, and what you remain is what you remain with is a diagram like that one.
The subscripts on the A, is that just
an okay. That's because, for example, in this case, that would be, let's say, two qubits, but they are two different ones. So they are the same type of system, but occurring in two different instances. Okay. So now I introduce the notion of extension of types by a trivial system, which is given recursively in this way. Okay? So first of all, the extension of a trivial system by a system A is the parallel composition of the two systems. So you compose the two systems into a composite one. And then if you have type X arrow Y, then its composition with trivial system with the elementary system A is this type X goes to Y parallel A. So if you develop this condition recursively, you will end up with the last elementary system appearing in this type Y, and then this will be just parallelly composed with A. So the parallel composition is not a new rule. you won't get anything that you don't get with simple arrows if you use parallel composition with trivial, with elementary systems. It's just that you describe some type in the hierarchy as the parallel composition of elementary system with your type x to y. Okay, so this is an identification of a type, and you and labeling. It's a labeling of one special type as this parallel composition. So this type will be the labeling of this kind. For example, to give you an idea of what I'm saying, suppose that you have a box of this type, x two channels from A to B. So this means that you will have a slot in the middle that accepts objects of type x, and what this map produces once x is plugged here is a channel from A to B. So for example, you have this type x, you plug it there, and then you have a channel. Okay. So now, what would composition with an elementary system, extension by an elementary system, mean in this case? It just means that you add an extra system C here. So the last system that appears in your in initial type will be extended by composition with the parallel system C. Okay. So why am I doing this? Because this notion is fundamental to define the axioms of admissibility on higher order maps. So admissibility, now I will tell you, just looks like the usual admissibility conditions I showed you in the previous cases, like linearity. I don't write it here because it's implicit, but linearity, of course, is always the case. And the admissibility conditions are that the maps are well behaved, not only on the objects of the input type, but also on objects that are extended with this extra system A. Okay? So this is a way of enforcing what would be complete positivity on a higher level. And then you say that the map is admissible if it can be complemented by a pool of other admissible maps to a sum which is deterministic. And the deterministic map of type X to Y is just a map that takes deterministic objects of type X and maps them into deterministic objects of type Y. So remember that X arrow Y follows X and Y, both X and Y in the hierarchy. So suppose that I already defined the set of possible transformations of type X, the set of possible transformations of type Y, then I know which are the deterministic one, both of type X and type Y, and then I can identify the deterministic transformation of type X to Y. These are those that preserve the deterministic condition. So an example of proof by induction that I give you immediately on this ordering of types that I introduced before is this property that each transformation in the hierarchy is admissible if and only if its Choi operator is positive. And here I have a warning. I mean, not all the positive operators represent admissible maps, but essentially up to a scale rescaling by a constant, you can take any positive operator into the set, the convex set of admissible maps. Okay? So, for example, not any positive operator describes a channel or a state, but if you rescale it, you will get a state, you will get a channel, or a quantum operation in general. So the good thing of this axiomatization of higher order transformation is that you can translate it in the language of operational probabilistic theories and do the same construction for any causal operational probabilistic theory.
Sorry, I don't really understand the second condition of being admissible. It seems to me like you're using the admissibility to define admissibility.
Admissibility?
What does it mean for the set of these maps?
As I told before, that the definition is recursive. So you suppose that the input and the output type have already been defined, so you know what are the admissible objects of these two types. So you just need to define admissibility on the new order in terms of preservation of admissibility on the previous orders.
For first order, you use the former.
I use the former, the x and the y or the x parallel A, x parallel y parallel A. So this is the same as in the case of channels. Okay, I know what are the states. These are the trace, like positive operators with trace less than or equal to one. This is the admissibility condition for states. And then I will say that a completely positive map is admissible as a channel if it preserves this condition.
OK, so that's the first condition. So what is the second one?
This one?
Yeah.
OK. This means that it can be complemented to a deterministic one. So you don't consider it as admissible a completely positive map, which is neither trace preserving nor trace non-increasing. So if it increases the trace, it's not admissible. Okay? A quantum operation is always complemented by another quantum operation to a channel. And this is the same condition that I am imposing here. I have a map T. And in order to be admissible, this must be positive, completely positive in a sense. So it must preserve admissibility also on extensions. And also, it must be upper bounded by a deterministic transformation. So it must be conceivable as a probabilistic transformation that occurs within a pool. But when you sum all the elements in the pool, you get a deterministic map.
Is it a form of purification axiom?
No, it's like saying that in the case of quantum operations, I collect quantum operations into instruments, and the instruments are characterized by the fact that if I sum all the elements in the instrument, I get a channel, a deterministic object. So this means that if I take O prime, and for this one, I find no complementation to a channel, then this would not be admissible. Because this means that it over-normalizes probabilities in the end. Okay, so I want it to be complemented by something else to a deterministic transformation. And this is what I'm requiring here. For my T, there must be a collection of complementing transformations such that when I sum all of them, I get the sum which is admissible and preserves the deterministic property.
At this stage, is it different from the condition you talked about earlier, the work you did with Mauro and Giulio?
This is not present in the work with Mauro and Giulio. So we did it only for maps from channels to channels, or from comps to channels.
This is
the generalization to any type you can conceive.
Y can be
exactly. So since you don't even know what exactly the types are, the definition must be a little bit abstract and obscure. But essentially, I'm just translating the same kind of admissibility conditions that you have for channels or quantum operations.
So that previous work is a special case of this?
Yes. Also the case of the switch. In that paper, we did something like that, but only for specific type of maps.
So my question was just, why do you need a set of these eyes? Why not just say there exists a single object such that when I sum it to T?
Well, this is a very... The reason is very technical. So essentially, the problem is that if I define this only with one complement, I need this to be admissible on the extended maps. So if I need to do this with if I need to do this only with one element instead of a collection, then I would have to require not only that it's admissible, but that it maps admissible object of this type to admissible object of this type. You see, this requirement is just one part of the admissibility condition. Okay. It must also satisfy the second one. So if I had just one object here, I have to impose this part of the requirement also to the sum. That's because, for example, maybe this sum is a single object, but any element of this sum, any SI is admissible, but the sum might not be admissible.
So I'm realizing that I'm actually confused about something deeper, which is I understood the first condition.
Yes.
I could read it as, okay, T is admissible if T tensor identity A maps admissible X bar A to admissible Y bar A.
Yes.
And I've already defined what admissible things of type
X parallel A
are because they're one type down.
Yes.
But then when I get to the next condition, we're asked whether there's an admissible S sub I, but S sub I is of the same type as the thing that I'm trying to define admissibility for. It's not one type down in the hierarchy. So how can that...
Yes.
I guess you've already answered this question when Tomas asked it, but I've lost track of what the answer was. How do you get away with having that SI admissible appear in the definition of something that's of the same type as SI?
Well, the point is that if I had just one element, I would need to say that the sum is admissible. Whereas if I have more than one, I just need to require that the sum preserve the deterministic property. So, okay. Sorry, maybe that, you're right. I misspelled this definition. So you should remove this admissible from here. Okay. So these ones are not admissible, but just satisfy the first item. Sorry, that's my mistake. I shouldn't rewrite this. If there was just one item here, I should add admissible, and then this condition would be kind of circular definition. So you see my point. So now, erase admissible.
Okay.
This transformation should only satisfy the first item,
okay,
which is not complete admissibility, because complete admissibility also requires the second item. Okay.
And so every instance of admissible in that dot should be replaced by the thing above. So when you talk about T plus sum over I, SI is admissible, can I also replace that, you know?
Yes, preserve
identity, maps, blah, blah, blah.
Preserve admissibility and deterministic property.
Okay.
I'm sorry about that.
Okay, I think that makes
more sense. This makes a confusion. This is already difficult to grasp without a mistake.
Or you could just say, there is blah that satisfies the first condition such that blah satisfies the first
yes.
condition and...
Problem is, if I do it only with one element, then if there's more than one, it's not granted that only that the sum would still satisfy the definition. So I need to do it with more than one, with a finite number. Anyway, we can discuss this later. It's a very subtle and technical point. But okay, so this is the axiomatization of maps of higher order. And as I told you, this is ready to be generalized to general operational probabilistic theories that have causality on the first level. And in the quantum case, you can prove by induction that these axioms imply essentially complete positivity. And not only that, because you see that there's an if and only if. This means that any positive operator in the suitable cone is proportional to some admissible map. Okay, so it's not only complete positivity, but more than that, any completely positive map up to some rescaling is an admissible one. So types come with a cone, because as I told you, they are represented by positive Choi operators. They are completely positive map. And then there's a positive cone of maps of a given type. However, the deterministic maps are given by the intersection of the cone with some linear constraint, which is given by the preservation of the deterministic property of the types, of the input type to the output type. And the probabilistic maps are those that are upper bounded by a deterministic one. So the correspondence between cones and types is not one-to-one. For an example of this is the cone of bipartite states and the cone of transformations from system A to system B. So the positive cones are the same. Any bipartite state is proportional to the Choi operator of some quantum operation. However, the difference between the two types comes with the normalization constraint. So the basic notion I would like to express now is the following, that types with the same cone but with different normalizations are different. On the other hand, we pose by definition that two types are the same if they have the same cone and they have the same normalization constraint. So it might occur that two types in the hierarchy have the same cone, have the same normalization constraint, then we identify them. Okay, this is a way of imposing equalities in the hierarchy of types. And it turns out that normalization is crucial for determining type equivalence. So the linear constraint is crucial. And as I remind you that this comes from the very first level from the causality of the theory. Okay, causality implies that states have to be normalized by a linear constraint, and then this propagates on the normalization constraint on the whole hierarchy. So there's another rule that I would like to add on my set of types, which is the parallel composition. Parallel composition is defined in this way. So it's just a definition. I'm not introducing a new rule. I'm defining just a type, a shorthand for a type, in terms of the old rule of the arrow. Okay? So I could define parallel composition only in terms of arrows. With this definition, it turns out that the cone of the tensor product is the cone of positive operators on the tensor product space of the two types. And the normalization constraint is given by the affine hull of tensor products of normalized elements of type X and normalized elements of type Y. Okay. So you can take these elements and take three affine combinations of these ones. And what you get, as long as you preserve the positivity, is a deterministic map of the type parallel composition. One important thing is that parallel composition is associative. So we can really think of it as the usual tensor product we are used to, even though the interpretation of this tensor product is more difficult than the one that we have on the basic level of parallel composition of systems. So,
symmetric monoidal, or is there some additional structure there?
No, it's just symmetric monoidal, but the interpretation is slightly different. And here I will just discuss the reason why is that. So, take, for example, the parallel composition of two channels. Okay, so the tensor product of two positive operators with partial trace equal to the identity would be something like that, describing the parallel composition of two independent quantum channels. So now, in their affine span, I have, of course, convex combination of these guys. And these are just what are referencing in the literature as LOSR, local operations with shared randomness. But there's more than that. There are affine combinations that are non-trivial, and still they are positive. And these are all the non-signaling channels. You can get the Choi operator of a non-signaling channel by taking affine combinations of tensor product of Choi operators of channels. Okay, this is an if and only if. So in general, in the tensor product of channel, you have very non-trivial things like those ones. So this is a theorem that we proved in 2011. A non-signaling channel, a bipartite channel is non-signaling. So this black box from AB to A prime B prime, if and only if it admits two alternative realization schemes in this way. So one is, you always must use, in principle, some entangled ancillary system. And the first scheme comes in this way. Alice measures some instrument on her system plus her ancilla, then communicates the classical outcome to Bob, And then Bob performs a conditional channel. Or the other way around. Bob does an instrument, communicates to Alice. Alice does a conditional channel. Okay. So if I had only this realization, this would be a channel with memory, with signaling from Alice to Bob. If I had only this realization, I would have a signaling channel from Bob to Alice. But if the channel admits both of them, then it means that this classical communication, which is necessary for the implementation, is not a resource that can be extracted from this black box. Because even though you need the communication to perform, to realize the channel, this does not allow you to communicate from A to B prime. Because you can always implement the channels also in this way. So you need classical communication, but the direction in which you use it is not fundamental. Okay. So as you see, in this affine hull of the tensor product, you will find very strange things happening. So causal structures which have non-trivial interpretation in terms of resources, communication resources that you need, in terms of what you can get out of the black boxes. So why didn't we define the arrow in terms of the tensor product? That's because if I do that, I need anyway the overline, which is defined in terms of the arrow itself. So does this definition make sense? Does it work in the case that I know the tensor product of two elementary systems, A and B? Well, the answer is yes, because this would be the tensor product, A arrow B bar, all overlined. And so A arrow B bar is easily to realize to be an effect of this kind because it takes a state of A into an effect of B. This is the most general completely positive map that takes a state of A into an effect of B. And then the functional on these is actually a state, a joint state of A and B. So you see that indeed the objects of this type are states of the bipartite system. So in the most elementary instance that we know, this definition makes sense. So, and in terms of the tensor product, I have this notion of uncurrying, which is given by this identity, the identity of types. So I remind you that the identity of two types is given by having the same cone and having the same normalization constraint. So whenever you have a map of this kind, x to y to z, well, I can think of feeding this with x, then I get a map from y to z, and then if I also feed y, I will get something of type z. Then this is equivalent to a map that accepts an x and a y and provides a z. Okay. So this equality can be rigorously proved in the quantum case in general, and actually it's equivalent to the associativity of the tensor product as I defined it before. So let's see uncurrying at work in a simple case. So a map of that kind, which is a map that accepts a channel as an input and provides a comb of this type as an output. Okay. So this is exactly a map of this type. Channel to comb, which is channel to channel, is like a pair of channels going into a third channel. So this type is indeed equivalent to this. So once I feed the first input, I get a map that accepts a second output and transform it into a channel. So I can see it equivalently as a map from tensor product of channels to the green ones. So this is very much similar to the typical situation that you have when you have a function of two variables, and you can see it as a function from the first variable to functions on the second variable. Okay? If I feed the function with x, I get g, which depends on x, and is a function from y to the output. So now I'm coming to the final results that I want to show. And this is the characterization of maps from combs to combs. So, first of all, what is a map from combs to combs? I remind you that a comb is a map from a comb with n teeth is a map from a comb with n minus one teeth to a channel, which is one comb. And then a map from a comb of type M to a comb of type N is exactly something like the objects that accept uncurrying. So I can take the tensor product of this guy and see the map as a map from tensor product of two types of combs into a channel. For example, a map from 1 to 2 is the example that I showed you in the previous slide, can be equivalently seen as a map from a tensor product of two 1 combs to a 1 comb, which is this example. And so if I have a map from channels to combs of this type, I can consider it equivalently as a map from a tensor product to channels. And a map of this type is the switch. Okay, the switch that was introduced in the literature, well, not in 2013, much earlier. It took a long time to get this paper accepted. The switch is a map that works in this way. It accepts as an input a pair of channels and produces as an output either the concatenation of the channels in this way, first the blue and then the red, or first the red and then the blue, depending on some flipped coin or some measurement on a qubit or whatever. So there's a theorem that grants that the switch cannot be realized in a quantum circuit because realizing the switch in a quantum circuit would be equivalent to having a time loop, something like that, which is supernormalized and in some cases then provides negative probability. If I have to complement this to a deterministic effect, then I have to introduce negative operators. So what if we go to maps from combs to combs? I will get the generalization of this situation, and then I have maps from tensor products of combs into channels. So for example, a map from a 2 comb to a 3 comb can be seen as a tensor product, as a map from a tensor product of two combs to a 1 comb. And then I can think of implementing this map in, for example, in these 6 alternative ways. So these are the two inputs. And I have a comb, maybe a dark blue comb, which is ordered in this way. So first the 0 tooth, then the 1 tooth, then the 2 tooth, and the 3 tooth. Or permutations of these. Of course, permutations that respect the orderings of these two objects. Okay, so I cannot have all the possible permutations of the 4 teeth, but only those that respect the internal ordering of the inputs. Then, since all these maps are allowed as maps on the tensor product, I can also take a fine combination of those ones. They will respect, for sure, the normalization constraint. And as long as what I get is still in the positive cone, this is an allowed map on the tensor product. But then, is this a more general thing that I can have? Well, there might be even something else. OK, so the result I want to conclude with is the following theorem. So you only need, actually, these combs that I showed you in the previous slide. And in particular, out of these 6 combinations, you'd only need 2, which are those two, the one in which the first comb is completely before the second one, and the other one in which they are completely reversed. So any other thing is in the affine span of these two types of combs. So if I take the affine span of these two types of combs, I get any conceivable map from 2 combs to 3 combs.
Okay. Oh.
Yes?
So can you go back to the previous slide? So the blue and like the different colored combs, are they of the same type or different type?
They are different types because they have different normalization constraints. So for example, take this one and this one. So this order means that if I trace on the final output space, I get identity on the output of the 3-tooth tensor positive operator elsewhere. Whereas here, if I trace here, I get identity on the 1, on the output of the 1 tensor something elsewhere. But these are two different conditions. Okay, I can have both at the same time, but indeed, in general, if I have this condition, then this one fails and vice versa. So they have different orderings.
Yeah, but you compare them in this like space of positive maps when you like
Yes, they are operators on the same Hilbert space, so you can think of them as mathematically living in the same environment. But when you think of their implementation, they are different. If you think of their causal structure, they are different. So that's the point. Actually, this is the big open question, which is the interpretation of these objects. And the problems with interpretation were introduced already by Oreshkov, Costa, and Bruckner with this example, which is based on what they call process matrices. Process matrices are just a special case of this higher-order type of maps, which are maps of this type, which are equivalent by uncovering to this kind. So essentially, they are maps from the tensor product of channels into probabilities. Okay, these are process matrices. And what they exhibit is a process matrix which cannot be interpreted easily in terms of a physical scheme. Indeed, what would be an easy interpretation of a physical scheme? If I had, instead of a general affine combination, if I had a convex combination of these two, then it would be easy. I flip the coin, and then I just decide which of the two combs to apply. Okay? So this is still conceivable physically. However, there exist affine combinations that are not convex combinations. And this is the example, for example, the one exhibited by these authors. But then there are also other maps that are conceivable in principle. Those that are purifications of some convex combination, and then they are essentially maps with a quantum control. And this is the quantum version of the switch. I can think of deciding the order in which I apply to black boxes depending on the state of a qubit. So I can have superposition. Actually, I can have entanglement between the state of the qubit and the path of the target system. Okay. So this is hardly conceivable, but technologically hardly, not in principle. This is like, I would say, a Schrödinger cat of devices. However, there are even other maps that cannot be interpreted neither as a purification of a classical convex combination nor as a convex combination per se. And then the problem of feasibility is a big question. So are those maps feasible even though we cannot conceive an implementation for them? Is it a matter of principle or is it a matter of technological knowledge or knowledge of the physical world that we have up to now? Do we need to add other constraints besides admissibility? Because all these maps are admissible in the sense that I introduced. So they respect, the only requirement that I impose is that they respect the basic rule of probability, positivity and normalization. So do we need to add something more to have transformations that are physically conceivable? And I don't like an answer like only ability to imagine a realization. I think that this is a mathematical problem. I can give you my personal favorite answer to this question would be that one day we will be able to do all these transformations. And it's just a matter of our present knowledge of quantum theory and the physical world. And then there are other technical problems related to the hierarchy of higher order transformations. So is there a simple rule to identify the normalization constraints of a given type? I give you the type, and you give me immediately the linear constraints. This is not an easy task in general. Is there a universal higher order set? So suppose that you have the C naught and the unitaries on single qubits plus some other higher order set. Can you do the whole hierarchy of transformations? This is a preliminary question to the question of a speed up, of course, because if you want to see a speed up in the higher order, you need to translate a protocol in higher-order transformation in terms of elementary transformations that are required to do the protocol. So this is all I want to say, and I thank you for your attention.
You mentioned the term uncurrying a number of times. That's from category theory?
Well, I encountered it in studying lambda calculus. It comes from the name of Haskell Curry, which is the guy who invented the term. So lambda calculus is based on computation thought of as, in which you think of functions as possible variables, and then uncurrying is exactly this operation of transforming a function of two variables into a function from one variable to functions.
So the equation that you wrote, x tensor y, is the same as x arrow y bar all bar. You know that one.
The definition of the tensor product.
Yeah.
Oops, sorry.
Yeah. Right. So that obviously looks like De Morgan's laws. I can define, you know, the AND operation in terms of entailment and negation in logic. Is that because logic is an instance of?
Yes. Actually, the answer to your question is given by Alex Kissinger and his collaborators. He showed that this is an instance of multiplicative linear logic. So not any logic, not the usual logic, but a particular logic, where you have all this composition of types that correspond to logic connectives. And multiplicative linear logic is a decidable logic, so this is good news because it means that we have a hope that the hierarchy is simple to study. But this is all I know.
Specific category theoretic system like that implements this particular definition or like by injunction type theoretic language, which is like lambda calculus, then you can think of like Curry, Hort, isomorphism, so on. So there are a few different systems that implement this particular rule. So a few questions. So in the original paper with this recursive condition with you and Mauro and Giulio, you end up showing these conditions give you a circuit realization,
mm-hmm.
and you get a complete set of conditions for these quantum cones, any allowed object. So something has changed here.
Yes.
Considering these more general maps, and I guess I don't. What is it that has been relaxed so that now you no longer get a complete, so now you have a more general set of objects?
Yes. Okay, so the point is, in that paper, essentially we consider maps from combs to channels. When we had different maps, we imposed an extra constraint, which is compatibility, which we called compatibility with remote connections. So why does this enforce the complete causal ordering? Because take this realization of the switch, for example. If you allow compatibility with remote connections, this means that this channel can be bipartite, this channel can be bipartite, and you allow some far away agent to connect the wires of these two channels in some way. Okay. So if the order of these two is determined by an external agent, then you cannot exchange it locally. It's determined far away. So if you want to be compatible with these remote connections, then you have to assign an ordering to all the teeth that appear in your map a priori, and then this ends up to be a comb. So if you relax this compatibility with remote connections, then you get this whole hierarchy of maps. And it turns out that this comes if you just impose those admissibility conditions that I showed you, and you deduce from them all the possible maps that you get.
OK. So that's good. So now can one imagine a sort of further level of relaxation, which is sort of the following. When I imagined indefinite causal structure in the context of quantum gravity,
I was imagining that you would have sort of local indefinite causal structure, that you wouldn't have local time ordering necessarily. But it seems like here you still have some kind of local causal structure, because your blue box, for example, the wire going in is before the wire going out. And that structure seems to be present in other places in your construction. Like there, for example, it's important that 2-0 is before 2-1, for example, and so on.
Okay, this is because I define maps from combs to combs. Okay. But now here, these results regard this special type of maps in the hierarchy. But you can have other types where this ordering is not specified. For example, you can have maps from an n-partite non-signaling channel, completely non-signaling. So this would be the span of a tensor product of channels. And there, the ordering is completely free, for example. So it depends on the special type you are studying. But let me say that I would say that also in this case that the ordering is only partially defined, because you see that the ordering between 0 and 1 is fixed, the ordering between 2 and 3 is fixed, but the ordering between the two, the light gray and the dark gray, is not fixed. So
So would you say it's completely general? Like even it seems like you always have these teeth, and at least on a single tooth there is an ordering. So it looks like you have local.
On a single tooth, you have an ordering. Yes.
So
input comes.
Something that you could relax even further, and then have a more general, because this would be like local indefinite causal structure.
A completely indefinite causal structure. No, I don't think you will get anything like that in the hierarchy. Actually, it's proved. Because you can prove it. I'm not going to convince you of the proof, but I just tell you that if you have two Hilbert spaces, H0 and H1, the only objects in the hierarchy that you can have on these spaces are bipartite states, or channels from 0 to 1, or channels from 1 to 0, or effects on these types, which are something like that, or something like that, or bipartite effects, and that's it.
Under what assumptions are those?
That the space underlying the type is H0 tensor H1. Okay. So this means that something like the thing that you want would be something that could be interpreted both as a channel from 0 to 1 and a channel from 1 to 0. But this is something that is not a type of this living on this space. So the only admissibility constraints don't lead you to such a relaxed structure.
There must be some assumptions besides just the mere Hilbert space.
Well, okay, the types must be obtained in the hierarchy imposing the admissibility conditions that I showed.
And do you like kind of assume some like bottom admissibility for like the channels, say?
Well, the lowest level is first order quantum mechanics, where you have states, channels.
Okay, so I guess that must be the assumption that kind of guarantees this kind of behavior.
Yes, sure. Of course, because the whole hierarchy is extracted from the basic level.
But maybe you could relax that piece.
You really need to relax the causality of quantum theory, I guess.
But that's the question, because we want indefinite causal structure, so we must relax even the most basic.
Or linearity assumption.
Well, okay. This would be too much. I would say linearity would be like allowing devices to read your mind when you take a decision. This is too much, I would say. But relaxing causality, of course, this is an option. I wouldn't like a theory without causality, at least in the first level. But I wouldn't like signaling from the future.
You have something like a superposition of different metrics, whatever that means, then it would apply locally, and so even there you would have to relax.
Well, but this is what the thing you're proposing is more than indefinite metrics. It would mean that really you have time reversal symmetry, complete time reversal symmetry. There's no difference between past and future. The difference is determined by the special instance, but not in general. Whereas in the causal theory, there's an asymmetry. The input is different from the output.
Yeah, it's clear it's easier to impose an asymmetry if you actually have a definite causal structure somewhere.
Okay. I understand. So that's about the meaning of indefinite causal structure. Here, apart from the fact that I tend to use indefinite causal structure as seldom as I can, but what I would mean is just that you have two different causal structures, and you don't have, in the most general case, you don't have even a convex combination of the two, but you have something which is beyond our understanding in terms of these structures.
Which is interesting.
But it's not so relaxed as you propose, in which you can exchange the on the top on the bottom level also the past and the future.
I wanted to ask for which sorts of types admissibility corresponds to being represented by a causal cone. So
that's,
I have like a process of type 1 tensor 1 to 1. That I guess the quantum switch proves that's an admissible thing of that type, but
mm-hmm.
it's not a causal cone, so it
yes.
shows that the admissible ones is a broader class. But if I have a process of type, you know, 1 to 1, it takes 1 combs to 1 combs. Is it possible that there all of the admissible guys correspond to causal combs, or is
yes.
it also a gap?
But for example, maybe I missed the meaning.
So you give this definition of admissibility. So my question is, if I apply that definition to the type, you know, 1 arrow 1.
1 arrow 1.
A larger set than the processes of type 1 arrow 1, which can be represented by a causal cone.
No, but maybe I misinterpreted your question. But it turns out that the special case you're making, 1 to 1, is a comb.
Right.
Anything like n to 1 are combs.
Do you mean like a causal cone? Like it has a
yes.
definite causal structure? Yeah.
Yes, because 1 to 1 is the first example that we studied. Maps from channels to channels, and we know that they are of this type. So they are circuits. 1 to 1, and anything of the type n to 1 is a comb. It's an n plus 1 comb. The problem is when this is more than one.
Okay. And then, so that's in your earlier work. The notion of admissibility you were using there is exactly the one you're using here, specialized to that case. Is that correct?
Yes. Plus the fact that in the paper, the theoretical framework for quantum networks, when we consider tensor product, we also impose compatibility with remote connections, which essentially brings this down to a n plus m comb. Because suppose that these two combs, which are independent, have to be compatible with remote connections. This means that some agent could introduce an ancilla here. So if you want to admit compatibility with the remote connections, you have to define a priori an ordering between these two and these two, so you exclude this part. Okay, but this is a requirement that is different from what you require on channels, for example. If you want to be free and just respect linearity, positivity, and normalization of probabilities, then that's what you get.
So, are you saying the conditions were stronger than in the original work?
Yeah, we put that condition in order to get combs at any level. But if you remove it, then you get more unstructured, more structured hierarchies of transformation.
What would be the most simple example of implementation that, because you said that this process matrix formalism is kind of a special case. So what would be the example of like most simple thing that would not fit to this broader of formalism and
like what should be an implementation of this framework?
Well, this, for example, maps from combs to combs. So they are not just process matrices, and they don't have just the freedom to choose the ordering of events. Because if you take an affine combination of a blue comb and a white comb, you have something which is beyond our present understanding of physical maps.
Because there is a possibility to combine them together.
But also in the case of process matrices, they showed an example which is of this type. So they showed an example of a process matrix which violates the causal inequalities in that language. And this means that essentially you cannot conceive them, you cannot conceive it as a convex combination of different orderings.
So following up on Rob's question, so we know every comb of type n to 1 can be realized as a circuit. Do we know that every type n to k not equal to 1 cannot, or has a specific case which cannot be realized as a circuit?
No, this one is a general theorem. So I showed you the picture only for the 2 to 3 case, but it's a theorem for the n to m case. So if n is bigger than 1, then you always have you have this uncurring inequality, and then you can take the m comb and the n minus 1 comb as the gray, dark gray and light gray, and you have these two orderings in which you exchange. Everything boils down to an affine combination of two types, but this affine combination is not a comb in general.
It seems surprising on the face of it that you would have just these two types. Is there a reason for it, or did it surprise you?
It was a tough proof. Then I guess it's not a simple reason, unless one can find an easier proof and understand the reason.
And are they, in the special case of process matrices, are your conditions of admissibility the same as the ones that the Vienna group uses?
But they use only, the admissibility condition that they want is positivity of probabilities, linearity, and normalization. And so these are the admissibility conditions that I showed.
If there are no questions, or even if there are, let's stop and thank Paolo.
Thank you.